Thank you, Bob, and happy Saturday afternoon to everyone in Chicagoland area and beyond. John Hansen in for Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. We got an abbreviated show today, so we're going to just jump right into things here today. You know, obviously the big story this week in Chicago was the huge election for Lori Lightfoot over Tony Preckwinkle on Tuesday, and that obviously has everyone wondering what's going to happen now in a Lightfoot administration. And since we're the Wintrust Business Lunch, we'll focus on the business aspects of it here this afternoon, and joining us is Robert Chanik of the Chicago Tribune. Robert, thanks for spending some of your Saturday afternoon with us.
Good to be here. Appreciate it.
So you wrote a really great article and just read the, it's comprehensive and it covers a lot of things, but you know, a lot of question marks are raised as we get a new administration. Obviously, Mayor Emanuel, known for bringing big businesses and raising the skyline high downtown, he would argue he's done a lot for the individual neighborhoods and the small business community as well. But I imagine that's where Lori Lightfoot wants to start as her administration gets started next month, with small businesses in the neighborhoods.
Exactly. Yeah, she laid out an economic plan on her campaign website, which is where, you know, we mine some of this information. But long and short of this, she actually sort of said that she thought previous administrations have focused too much on downtown development and not enough on the neighborhoods. And her plan is to have a more balanced approach, including access to capital for startups and neighborhoods and incubators out in the neighborhoods and all kinds of things to try to generate sort of local, smaller businesses as opposed to going big, which I think would be fair to say is how the Emanuel administration will probably look to history, with a lot of corporate relocations and big buildings and big businesses moving forward in the past 8 years under Emanuel.
For a couple of years, I spent time as a reporter over at the now-defunct DNA Info, which is reborn as Block Club Chicago. We did a lot of chatting with small business owners, like I'm sure you do, Robert, and, you know, there's that philosophy of kissing the ring of the alderman, and Lori Lightfoot has said that's one of her missions, is to kind of end that practice.
Right. She spoke to some folks at an incubator during the campaign and said she wanted, you know, businesses to not have to win approval and support necessarily of the local alderman in order to get anything passed, in order to develop businesses in various neighborhoods. And that would be a change. It's, you know, hard to say how that will shake out.
Yeah.
But again, it's all about just trying to streamline access for startups and smaller businesses to get a foothold, and particularly in the West and South Side neighborhoods that have a dearth of development. So she's just trying to sort of shift the balance from downtown to neighborhoods that have been, let's say, development deserts, if you will, and we'll see how it plays out.
Yeah, one of the gentlemen you talked to in your article is Howard Tolman, which is interesting because as I was reading the article at the start of it, I thought, you know, just about a year ago, I was in this exact studio co-hosting a show with Tolman. And we talked, this is before Mayor Emanuel announced that he wasn't running, and he mentioned, you know, how Mayor Emanuel is this global mayor, and no one can hold a candle to the businesses that he can bring into Chicago. And I read similar sorts of quotes in your article. And I guess the question I have is, does it have to be one or the other? Does devoting more resources to small local businesses in the neighborhoods take away from efforts downtown? And I wonder if there's a way to bridge the gap and do both at the same time.
I'm sure there is a way to do both, and in fact, you know, Emanuel supporters and proponents would say he's done that, although it's clear again that the most visible results are the bigger wins over the last 8 years, like we said. I think one of the things that, you know, Howard Tolman was concerned that, you know, Emanuel has been such a booster, and particularly in the tech community, and it's made a huge difference. I think went from being like 2% of the Chicago economy to 14% during the Emanuel administration. And 1871, obviously a big part of helping generate new business and startups in Chicago. But the concern is, if we take our foot off the gas at all, that other cities will be waiting in the wings, luring, you know, tech companies to expand. And you have Salesforce and all these other companies that have been expanding in Chicago. And so if you're focusing outside of that world, it's conceivable that Chicago could lose a little ground, and at least that was the concern Howard Tolman expressed, in you know, winning some of these larger and you know, tech entities that are expanding. I mean, look at Amazon again as, you know, the great prize of the last year. would have brought a lot of jobs to Chicago. And,
right.
And it's, you know, I think even though New York ended up pulling the plug on that, it's still something I think most municipalities would want to pursue. It's just a concern about limited resources, I think, more than anything.
Yeah, and when you say pulling the foot off the gas, is that a matter of, you know, maybe sentiment changing about the benefits you can offer corporations, the tax breaks? And you mentioned New York there, and Tolman sort of mentions that that could be a cautionary tale for Chicago, the local support waning for things like Amazon. I guess that's what they mean by pulling off the gas, is just kind of changing the sentiment and maybe some of the practices of allowing corporations and the benefits that they give them when they come to town.
Right, and it's debatable, and I've talked to a few economists who say that if you give away too much to lure a business, it's a losing proposition anyway. You know, it's not a simple black or white issue that, you know, you can offer any incentive and it pays dividends. So that's something that's been debatable for a while. And you look at what's going on with Foxconn up in Wisconsin, same thing. Do they give away too much to lure them up there? But I think, you know, as you think through this thing, one of the folks I spoke with, Alan Sanderson, an economist at the University of Chicago, thought this was sort of a potential red herring that, you know, as a free market economist, he wasn't so sure that large or small is really the thing we should be looking at. You know, big business, small business, it's just what's going to ultimately be good for Chicago. And everyone acknowledges that there are neighborhoods in Chicago that are hurting, that need assistance. But he brings the point that if Chicago is flourishing, you know, by promoting the larger businesses in downtown, there's other ways, there should be other ways to sort of spread the wealth.
Right.
And if we start losing ground, it might be harder to help out some of the neighborhoods in need. So there's just, different viewpoints on how to get from here to there. But everyone acknowledges that you speak with that, you know, there are neighborhoods in Chicago that need more help than they've been getting.
We'll wait and see what happens as Lori Lightfoot takes the oath next month. And Robert Chanik, thanks for all your help today and for joining us here on the Winter's Business Lunch.
My pleasure.
All right, quick break here, and then we're going to talk about the opioid crisis and some new news about the Sackler family after this on 720 WGN. It's 12:21 on this Saturday afternoon, shaping up to be a pretty good weekend across the Chicagoland area. Here, John Hansen filling in for Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch just for a few more minutes. And we're going right up to White Sox baseball. And, of course, we don't have enough time to break down the entire opioid crisis. And it's a story that deserves a deep dive. And, honestly, it's one that, while we hear those buzzwords a lot, it's just incredibly harrowing to dive through. The history of OxyContin and other painkillers. And one of the big producers, the producer of OxyContin, is Purdue Pharma. And their family, the Sackler family, which I gotta admit, as we talked to Jared Hopkins here on WGN, is a family I really haven't heard much about. I know a little bit about them. But Jared, they're in the news, and thanks for joining us here on the Winter's Business Lunch.
Thanks for having me.
So the latest is, I mean, their story goes back generations at this point. They took over the company in the 50s, and OxyContin comes about, I believe, in the 90s, and then we have all these lawsuits and this crisis in our country. What's the latest? This family, they're very philanthropic. They're a $13 billion family, so why shouldn't they be? But that might be changing, or at least they're kind of coming off some of these nonprofit boards, right?
Yeah, I mean, with the Sacklers for decades are probably well known around the world for philanthropy, the Met Museum in New York City, here where I am, and then a number of other institutions where they've made donations, and people recognize that name for that. The other side, though, is that the family, certain members of the family, own Purdue Pharma, which launched OxyContin in the 90s. What's going on now is that they and Purdue Pharma and a number of other drug companies and wholesalers are facing more than 1,000 lawsuits around the country and allegations for their role in allegedly starting the opioid crisis that in America now kills more than 100 people every day.
You know, it's interesting because I was reading about the company and that they, you know, they've pled guilty at least in one federal case back in 2007, I believe, and investigations have continued. Why now? Is it because this story and it's in fact impacted so many people and these lawsuits just keep on growing? Is pressure on these nonprofits and these institutions to not have them on the board? Are they stepping away to not be distractions? I imagine we're hearing from both sides on that.
Yeah, so what's going on with the Sacklers themselves is that Purdue, unlike some of these other companies like Johnson & Johnson or Teva Pharmaceuticals, Purdue is private. It's a private company. The family controls it and owns it. Certain members do. And what's come up in some lawsuits is that they are alleged to have a strong role in marketing and operating the company. So that's why they're personally named in a lot of these lawsuits as opposed to other companies, and are very wealthy, as you mentioned. The company did plead guilty in 2007 to deceptive marketing, and they paid a fine of $600 million. What's going on now in the latest round of lawsuits here are brought by cities, counties, and states, often trying to recoup money that they spent, that they say was due to the opioid crisis, you know, for law enforcement or hospital use, that's cost these counties and cities the toll. The flip side here on the philanthropy is that given the attention on this issue and that the Sacklers are under scrutiny here from in the lawsuits, is that museums around the world are questioning their relationships. And the number of them, the Tate in London, for example, have said that they won't accept future money from the family. And then the family has come out and said that they are, in some charities that they run, that they're pausing donation around the world. And as we reported yesterday, is that here in New York City, is that they two members of the Sackler family are stepping down from the prestigious New York Academy of Sciences. And so another one had Mortimer Sackler had stepped down from the Guggenheim, which is a well-known museum. So there is a lot of movement here going on that some of the nonprofits are questioning other relationships here.
Jared, you're in New York City. Is this a reaction to, you know, people of the public demanding this sort of thing, or is this a precautionary thing as these lawsuits continue to make their way through the courts?
You know, it could be a little of both. There are some activists around the world that have staged protests at some of these museums and nonprofits and said that they want the museums to change their policies or to stop accepting funds. But there's also just, you know, the idea of the media attention that's been covering a lot of this has continued because it is the number of lawsuits that are being filed. There are lawsuits that have been filed more than 1,000, and some of them are continuing. I mean, I think over the last few weeks, there's been some additional ones.
Yeah. It's a story that's not going away, to say the least. Yeah.
Well, Purdue and the Sacklers did settle one lawsuit, or they've agreed to settle one lawsuit with the Oklahoma Attorney General for about $270 million. Yeah. And then a good portion of that will go towards addiction treatment.
Right.
And so that could be seen as a model as to how to resolve a lot of this.
Jared, we are out of time. We appreciate you from jumping on in. Jared Hopkins from the Wall Street Journal. Have a good rest of your Saturday. Okay, Jared?
Thank you. You too.
All right. We're going to do the news in a bit and then White Sox after that on 720 WGN.